These lights-out stories are definitely not for the timid soul. If you frighten easily, turn off your radio now.
Yeah, go ahead. Turn off your radio. See if I care. Doesn't bother me one bit, because I've got stories from radios that were turned off a long time ago. In fact, 25 years ago, exactly.
Dora, I beg you!
Hey, mister, what is she talking about?
In back of you, look!
Yeah, look in back of you, way back in your rearview mirror of time, because that's what we do here at Playback. I'm your host, Carrie Thompson. And it's October 1986, which means it's spooky time.
A worm, 10, 20, no.
In radio, I found a way of getting inside the mind of the listener, into the very psyche of the listener.
Arch Obler talks about his stream of conscious radio dramas with NPR's Scott Simon. And then we have a story featuring this common tool.
If you want to try your hand at losing a thumb, spend some time around a chainsaw. It slices through wood like through butter. It eats human flesh faster than that.
We even have a wacky interview with film director John Waters.
My goal in life is to have a happy childhood as an adult. I can be as juvenile as one. I mean, I was paid to go try to find where Francis the Talking Mule was buried.
So you see, it's a real smorgasbord of genuine radio goodness. Straight out of the block, a hard-hitting story. Croissants versus muffins.
I think Americans wised up. They don't want to eat fancy foreign food.
Fritz Streiff is the maitre d' at Chez Panisse, the famous Berkeley eatery that many critics consider the most inventive restaurant in America.
But I'd say that your croissant eater is more likely to drive a foreign make of an automobile than your muffin eater.
Streiff says the Big Muffin conversion hit California at least 2 years ago. Still in all, a food trend can't really be a food trend until it's hit New York City. So we called New York's biggest bakery, Zaro's, in Grand Central Station. Roy Flicker manages Zaro's Bakery, and he sells 400 dozen croissants plus 400 dozen muffins every Monday and Tuesday.
My selection of croissants includes ham and cheese, turkey, sausage and pepper, broccoli, spinach, and knockwich and cheddar cheese.
Not to mention conventional breakfast versions of croissants filled with jams and chocolates. Still, Flicker says muffins have moved in fast, now equaling his croissant sales.
Now the same people who came up with the idea of croissants come up with 15 different kinds of muffins, plus a diet muffin. No salt, no sugar. We'll pass them by next year.
Andrea Egan is a New York health writer who is also known for her fine confections. She does not mourn the passing of the croissant.
I'm not that distressed by it, actually, because the croissants that we were getting weren't worth eating. But the problem is the muffins, which they put out on trays and they look like little clumps of coagulated gravel.
Ultimately, Egan says, the butter-bound croissant just became incompatible with American lifestyles.
First of all, they're very greasy. When you eat one of those croissants, it really does get all over you and they never give you enough napkin. And you can't wipe them on your business suit.
Okay, I'm sorry. I had to include that little slice of 80s angst. And now, here's a quiz for you. Name that voice.
With autumn here and winter following close behind, people in the colder regions of the country are putting up storm windows, finding
no,
their snow
that's
tires
not Barbara Walters. That's Public Radio's very own Terry Gross, filling in as host of All Things Considered with this cheery story.
For those who plan to gather their own wood, commentator Clay Morgan has some advice.
If you want to try your hand at losing a thumb, spend some time around a chainsaw. Its cutting chain spins at 9,000 RPM and it slices through wood like through butter. It will undo 400 years of growth in 5 minutes. It eats human flesh faster than that. But many of us now heat our homes with wood stoves and the fuel has to be brought in before the snow flies. So we put the dogs and the chainsaws in the back of the pickup and a case of beer on the seat between us and we head out looking for snags. Snags are more dangerous than chainsaws. Snags are gone trees that have cured on the stumps and their hazards are hidden in the grain. By leaving some holding wood to one side of our cut, we can swing the tree around to fall where we want it. But gravity has a lot to do with it, too, and trees falling the wrong way tend to grow as they fall. My friend Andy once watched a falling tree grow an extra 30 feet before it squashed his pickup. The taller the tree and the worse way it's falling, the longer it takes to fall. Though it takes more time, it gathers more power from gravity's commitment to finish a job. Andy's tree took forever. It was already 200 years old and 100 feet tall, but it stretched itself out and grew before it died. We were 20 years old, but I felt like I was 10. The thrill was electric. I shouted as the tree tilted toward his truck. I screamed and Andy shut off his chainsaw. I could tell by the look on his face that he understood. He was felling a tree on his truck. He smiled at me, kind of sickly. Then in panic, he attempted the impossible. He put his shoulder and face into the bark of the falling tree and he pushed with all his strength. I can close my eyes and still see that moment. The tree drove Andy into the ground and the percussion from the earth bounced him back on his feet. Unhurt but senseless, Andy danced a knock-kneed stagger around in a circle and sat down on the trunk of the tree. He looked along the shaft of that fallen giant to see its limbs still waving their branches. He had folded up his pickup, like a man's wallet, right behind the cab. I've had my surprises, too. When a chainsaw is running, that's all you can hear. A treetop broke out once and fell on me. It broke three teeth, dislocated my jaw, cracked two ribs, and drove a branch into my throat. I couldn't speak. For a while, I couldn't breathe. As my friend came to help me, I lay there bleeding, and I thought about chainsaws and staying alive.
And now, to brighten things up a bit, here's NPR's Noah Adams.
Filmmaker John Waters has made a career out of bad taste. On any given evening, one of his movies, Pink Flamingos, Polyester, or perhaps Desperate Living, is probably playing at a midnight show somewhere. John Waters is also a writer with a new book. It's called Crackpot, The Obsessions of John Waters. The book is filled with the things most important to the writer, snippets from the National Enquirer, Hollywood gossip, and slippers made out of Kleenex boxes. And it probably won't be too long before Crackpot is translated into Japanese. Waters says his movies are a hit in the Far East.
They had Pink Flamingos playing in department store windows. I couldn't believe it.
Why in Japan, do you think?
I don't know. They had never. This is just this year. We sold all seven films on video and theatrical. And I went there on this tour, and it's a great place to go to. It's the only place in the world they pay you to talk to the press, which I couldn't believe. And in every interview, they kept saying to me, when did you change your name? And I couldn't figure out what they were talking about. It's not like my name is Meatloaf or something. And finally, my friend that was with me said they think that only English words in it were John Waters, like toilet waters. And they thought that was very funny. And I had never even thought of that before in my life.
Are they dubbed in Japanese?
No, subtitles. But the subtitles go down the side rather than the bottom. And they do have censorship there, but it's great. It's this little optical ball that comes down. What you cannot show is pubic hair. That's the only thing you can't show. You can show anything else. And it stays in the crotch, and if the person turns 1 minute, it disappears. If they turn around, it comes right back, and it must take hours to put this in.
I wanted to ask you, because you're not a comedian, but you have written perhaps one of the funniest lines of the last decade, which is, the whole reason to have sex is because cigarettes taste better afterwards.
I really think that's true, that when you start to have sex, you think, oh boy, this is, not only is the orgasm going to be great, but think how good the cigarette will taste better. Cigarettes are always better after eating and having sex.
Hmm. You are perhaps the strongest booster, outside of her husband, of Pia Zadora, who you call the star of the 80s, the star, or who will be the star of the 80s.
Yeah, and she's got 5 years. I think it's too easy a shot to make fun of Pia Zadora. I think she's good. I like Butterfly. I thought she was really great and trashy in it, which is what the role called for. I think she can sing. I think she has also a very good sense of humor about herself, which I think is very, very important. And I'd love to use her in a movie.
You say she's too easy to take a shot at, yet you say about her that she is shorter than Elizabeth Taylor and cuter than Alvin the Chipmunk.
Well, I don't think that's putting her down. I think that's a compliment. I love Alvin the Chipmunk. I like Elizabeth Taylor. All the people I compared her to were role models to me. So I thought it was a compliment.
You have been talking for some time about two sequels to your films. One of them is Divine Meets Francis the Talking Mule. Francis was a hero of my childhood. The other has to do with Pink Flamingos, and it's much too long for me to recall.
Well, if I can remember it, I think it's Pink Flamingos meets Emmanuel in Bangkok, Beneath the Valley of the Ultra Vixens, Part 6, the final chapter in 3D.
Hmm. Are you going to get a chance on this tour of the country publicizing your book to go into Hollywood and have a meeting with one of these big-time movie executives?
Well, I've done that before. I've gone the pitching experience, yeah. which I've done, which I talk about in Crackpot. Yeah. What happens is that because of Pink Flamingos and Polyester, it gets me the appointment. But then what happens is his boss, the main executive, says, fine, let's screen Pink Flamingos. And I know as soon as I hear that, there it's over, because they'll flip out when they watch it. So the movies get, it's the ultimate catch-22 position. It gets me in the door and keeps me out.
You are just a bit bitter about it, because you talk about television programs, movies for television, as being the ultimate exploitation films.
Yeah, but I'm not bitter about that. I mean, that's just the way things are now. I think that the golden age of trash is coming to an end. I think that there really are no exploitation movies anymore because Hollywood does them. And when an exploitation film costs $20 million, it takes the fun out of it. There's no punch left. And I think that it's hard to be a teenager, is what I was saying, because every time you think of a way to get on your parents' nerves, they make a TV movie about it the next week saying, oh, this is really okay, and you understand the problem, so there's no way left to rebel. But I think it's switched. There's really no more drive-in movies anymore. Now they're on TV. But I'm not against that. Maybe, you know, in 10 years, my movies might be on TV.
I formulated this theory a few years back about any sort of adult occupation, any sort of adult endeavor, which is that life really does not go beyond junior high school.
I agree. My goal in life is to have a happy childhood as an adult. I can be as juvenile as one. I mean, I was paid to go try to find where Francis the Talking Mule was buried.
Where is Francis?
Jerome, Arizona.
Is there a little shrine there for Francis?
No, it was on a ranch, and it was buried there. They took him from L.A., the SPCA. I was really terrified. I went to the all the glue factories in L.A., thinking, I wonder if they took him there. When I couldn't find him in any of the pet cemeteries, they'd tell me, no, we have Hopalong Cassidy's horse, Jerry Lewis's cats, you know, that kind of stuff. And I finally found the director, and he also directed Mr. Ed, by the way. He knew where he was.
Who was the guy who was the voice of Francis the Talking Mule?
Chill Wills.
Chill Wills.
Yes.
Yeah. And then Mr. Ed starred a guy named Alan Young.
I only saw Mr. Ed a few times. The best time is when Mae West was the guest on it. I don't know if you ever saw that particular show where it was really dirty. She had so many double entendres with Mr. Ed, which was pretty kinky for early television.
You never heard of a talking horse? Well, listen to this. I am Mr. Ed.
1986 marked the 50th anniversary of the first east-to-west flight across the Atlantic by aviatrix Beryl Markham. Here's a profile of Markham from NPR's Susan Stanberg.
New York City, September 6, 1936. A ticker tape parade and Mayor Fiorella LaGuardia greeting a tall, blonde English woman who just the day before had completed a 21-hour and 25-minute flight across the Atlantic, Abingdon, England, to a nameless swamp nonstop.
Ms. Markham, may I, on behalf of the City of New York, extend to you a sincere welcome and our congratulations on your splendid flight across the ocean.
Happy to be here. Thank you so much.
9 years after Lindbergh, and going in the other direction, his Spirit of St. Louis soloed New York to Paris, Beryl Markham, 34 years old, had flown 17 of the 21 and a half hours in fog and darkness, with no fuel gauge, no radio, no idea where she was most of the time, to crash land after the engine of her monoplane died in a bog on Cape Breton Island, Nova Scotia. The next day, she was being cheered in New York.
It was a hard battle against the elements above the ocean, fog and storm. But pluck and endurance crowned one of the most grueling flights on record.
I am so pleased to have got here. I only wish I could come in my own machine.
And now on to a New York hotel to be interviewed by Movietur. Mrs. Markham, just what were you thinking about while flying through all that fog and storm?
Well, my one thought and ambition was to get to America.
When above the sea, what did you eat or drink?
I didn't have anything until the last half hour when I had the sprigs of brandy.
Just one?
No, two, I'm afraid.
Aviation was very young then. Every single day without fail, there were two or three articles in the newspapers about people being killed in aircraft. It was a completely new sport.
Mary Lovell has just completed a biography of Beryl Markham.
The engines were not very reliable. All she had was a compass and some kind of direction-finding equipment that didn't work very well. She really didn't know where she was for a long time. She had no idea how far off the coast she was, whether her fuel would last. I think the one time in her life she has been frightened was then.
For most of her 83 years, Beryl Markham was indeed fearless. As a child growing up in Africa, she faced down marauding lion. As a trainer, she forced high-strung racehorses to obey her. As an old woman, she drove her car through machine gun fire during an attempted coup in Kenya. She wanted to keep a luncheon date. It was simply her nature to confront danger.
There's a coolness to her. She's not a very trusting person.
Writer Judith Thurman.
I think any person who's lived by her wits would probably have developed that coolness. Look at the astronauts. I mean, it's a quality that you see it in flyers, you see it in sailors, and you see it in hunters. And Beryl was of that stamp.
There were other interpretations of Markham's coolness. Some said she lacked the sense to be afraid. People often said nasty things about Beryl Markham, especially other women. It's easy to figure out why.
She was beautiful. She was very seductive. She was well-born. And she was strong and ambitious and fearless and smart. So, you know, it's a lot to take.
Beryl Markham became a freelance bush pilot, flying mail, passengers, and supplies on mercy missions. Like horses, airplanes were vital then in this part of the world. They needed planes to get to places which roads wouldn't connect until decades later. The planes were primitive, constructed of wood, covered in cloth. The flights were dangerous to remote parts of East Africa, over jungle and desert where emergency landing fields were marked by old tin cans filled with lighted kerosene and fenced in against lion. Markham carried a Luger and morphine in case she crashed in the bush. Searching for even greater adventure, she found another use for planes, scouting big game. Guides like Dennis Finch Hatton and Broer Blixen led European and American millionaires on safari in Africa. Their clients had to be rich and patient. Beryl Markham wrote,
"The essence of elephant hunting is discomfort in such lavish proportions that only the wealthy can afford it."
From the cockpit of her scouting plane, Markham jotted down locations on paper strapped to her thigh, put the paper in weighted message bags, and flung the bags down to the hunter. Broer Blixen picked up this note.
"Very big bull. Tusks quite even. My guess, over 180-pounder. In herd of about 500. Dense growth, high trees, two waterholes. No rhino sighted. Your course, 220 degrees. Distance about 10 miles. We'll be back in 1 hour. Work hard. Trust in God and keep your bowels open. Oliver Cromwell."
The writer Martha Gellhorn says that's her favorite passage in West with the Night, the place where the real woman comes out, fearless, competent, professional, funny, too. Unlike the rest of the book, says Gellhorn, that passage has no literary style at all. It's just scribbled down fast and funny. The story of the woman who flew west on that difficult, dangerous night in 1936 will be told and retold. Through the darkness, wedged between extra fuel tanks that had been fitted into the cabin for the long journey, her small plane bucking fog and storms and headwinds, the Atlantic Ocean black beneath her, Beryl Markham flew west with the night, completely alone.
"You can live a lifetime and, at the end of it, know more about other people than you know about yourself. You learn to watch other people, but you never watch yourself because you strive against loneliness. If you read a book or shuffle a deck of cards or care for a dog, you are avoiding yourself. The abhorrence of loneliness is as natural as wanting to live at all. If it were otherwise, men would never have bothered to make an alphabet, nor to have fashioned words out of what were only animal sounds, nor to have crossed continents, each man to see what the other looked like. Being alone in an aeroplane, for even so short a time as a night and a day, irrevocably alone, with nothing to observe but your instruments and your own hands in semi-darkness,
Nothing to contemplate but the size of your small courage. Nothing to wonder about but the beliefs, the faces, and the hopes rooted in your mind. Such an experience can be as startling as the first awareness of a stranger walking by your side at night. You are the stranger.
And now, more radio with an attitude from NPR's Scott Simon.
There are certain times and certain seasons when this machine we're sitting with, this radio, becomes a hearth or a campfire. And we gather around it to hear stories.
All right, now there's something screwy going on up here. I don't know what it is, but I'm waiting for you to tell me. Come on, Croc, it's in your face. Out with it.
You don't see anything?
I see plenty. You and your wife sitting here staring at nothing.
Nothing?
Listen, mister, please. Listen.
I'm listening.
Take out your guns. Shoot him. Kill him.
Huh? Who?
There, in back of you. Quick.
Dora, I beg you.
Hey, mister, what is she talking about?
In back of you. Look.
One of radio's most prolific and noted storytellers is Arch Obler, who by his own estimate has written at least 850 radio dramas, including the classic radio thriller series Lights Out. Mr. Obler is 76 years old. He was the first playwright to have his own series on network radio and the first playwright to be given a national program in prime broadcast time. He's also written for the movies, stage, and cassettes of his work are now available under the title Lights Out, Everybody.
These Lights Out stories are definitely not for the timid soul. So we tell you calmly and very sincerely, if you frighten easily, turn off your radio now.
And Mr. Obler joins us from his home in Studio City, California. Mr. Obler, thanks for being with us.
Nice to be here, Scott.
Well, Mr. Obler, what makes something frightening?
Oh, it's very simple as far as I'm concerned. Hollywood and television overcomplicate it. They have tremendous sound effects and special effects departments. I say that far more horrible are the horrors within ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
What monster can I create that's greater than the horror in each of us of the woman we didn't like, the husband who left us, the boss who was a monster? Write about those things, the things of our ordinary life and our everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
And it's terror beyond terror.
You've got a play, Mr. Obler, I want to ask you about. Revolt of the Worms.
Yes, Revolt of the Worms. I remember that
one. Holes. Holes in the ground all over. What are they? Who? Animal burrows.
It is as if we are hearing somebody's mind unreal in our own through many stretches of that.
In that play, you recall this, that character was a florist who had sort of retreated from the world to go on into his own world of raising roses, of bringing out new species.
Yeah.
Something happens chemically, and when he discards the fertilizer, the worms in the ground outside of the greenhouse begin to grow into monstrous things.
I fell to the ground, and I saw as I lay there, I saw. The thing moved toward the hole in the ground as if you weren't there. As if it were blind and couldn't see. Like a great blind worm. It was a worm. A worm 30 feet long, crawling in fright to its home in the ground. And it moved toward you, Claire. Covered you. Crushed you.
In radio, I found a way of getting inside the mind of the listener, into the very psyche of the listener. Back in the times of the 30s, when I started in radio, drama was an imitator of the motion picture medium, of the theater, mm-hmm. I said to myself, if I'm as close to the listener as the microphone that is bringing it to them, why can't I get within the listener? And so I began using the stream of consciousness.
Mm-hmm. I would like for a moment to talk about Strange Morning, the play with Ingrid Bergman.
There's been all sorts of excitement.
Excitement?
Mm-hmm. You see, Freddie, it's finally happened. Germany's out of the war. Freddie, did you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, I thought you'd like to know.
Yes, thank you. Did it rain last night?
Yes, it did.
I thought I heard rain. I guess they're underwater.
What?
40 acres down by the creek. My father tried to drain that land ever since I was a pup.
Ingrid Bergman, playing the part of a nurse, going around the hospital, given the unhappy duty of telling these badly wounded soldiers, these never-to-be-whole-again people, that peace has come with Germany, and the reaction of these men...
I hate this day, because now we'll stop killing them. The sentimentalists will begin. They'll stand on righteousness and wave the words of charity, pity, and compassion. And the grass will grow over the murdered, and the cities will be rebuilt. And the torn throats and the whipped backs and the screams and the bloody marks on the walls will be forgotten. Yes, forgotten, because only a few of us saw those things with our own eyes. Forgotten because our people never had hatred poured into their veins with the death of their wives and their children. I hate this day.
Peace was in the wind, but I could see no peace. I could see no peace because the basis of peace has to be more than the simple words, we're not fighting, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Obler.
Well,
thank you very much. Nice meeting you.
Nice meeting you, and I hope we meet again.
All right, now that we've completely freaked everyone out, here's our final story from one of NPR's original staff members, Mike Waters.
There was a time when the mischievous works of gremlins were almost legend. But now people talk about bugs in the equipment. It's not bugs. It's the gremlins. There is one night every year, when some gremlins are acknowledged. And that night is Halloween. I know a gremlin who on Halloween night goes skipping down a street until it sees a lighted porch. It will climb the stairs, reach up, press the doorbell, and wait for the lady of the house to come, who invariably will say something like, "You're a little gremlin, aren't you?" The gremlin will nod, and she will say, "Would you like some taffy?" And the gremlin would say, "No." "You have a deep voice." The gremlin would nod. "What's your name, child?" "Inky." "Do you live in this neighborhood, child?" "No." "What's your last name, child?" "Gall." "Inky Gall. Would you like some Tootsie Rolls, Inky Gall?"
"No."
"What would you like?"
"I'd like to mess up your TV."
"Is your mother out there on the sidewalk?"
"No."
John, would you come in here, please?
"Barbara, the TV's gone funny. I have to fix it."
"Inky Gall, I think your mother wants you. I think you should go home right away." The gremlin smiled, or grimaced, which is the way a gremlin smiles. And as it moved across the porch, it turned and said,
"I've messed up every drop of milk in your refrigerator."
And the woman knew that all the milk in the refrigerator was sour. Inky Gall turned, bounced down the steps, and skipped down the street, looking for another house where the porch lights were lit. Now, there is no such thing as insurance against gremlins. So if you answer your door on Halloween, you should know Not everyone that looks like a gremlin is a child. And not everyone is interested in treats.
That story, Watch Out for Gremlins, from Mike Waters. Okay, well, if it's any consolation, next month we have normal scary stuff, like the Iran-Contra scandal and global warming. Special playback thanks this month go to Michael Katziff and our very first playback intern, Claire DeMiro. I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback.